Well, we're getting close to election time, and so we need to give you a public service. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hey, it's very good to be back with you, Barry. We missed last week, and for that I apologize. I was having a procedure done.
Yes, and when I was on with Mike, I let everybody know that to pray for you because you were going under the knife, or is it the pliers?
I went under the pliers.
Pliers.
It's the first time I've ever been awake during a tooth extraction, and it's not the kind of experience I would care to repeat. It wasn't my favorite thing to ever have done.
Well, I get that, but thankfully you came through with flying colors. And you're healing up well, so we're back and in the studio and trying to get another great week of activity that's happened around us in, so that we can let everybody know what's going on. And you know, Chuck, the big thing that's going to be going on, and you know, I know we're, depending on how you look at it, we're either early or we're late. We're late because, according to the Ohio Secretary of State's office, there have been over 175,000 absentee ballots that have been requested through their office for people to vote early before Tuesday, May the 8th. Now, if you look at the numbers, the number of ballots that have actually been cast is a pale comparison to that 175 plus thousand that have been requested. But, you know, needless to say, some people have already cast their ballots. Maybe some who are listening to our program have already cast their ballots. And so the information we're going to give them, they probably would have said, I wish you'd have told me that 3 weeks ago. But we were trying to gather up some of the information ourselves because it's been a crazy season. And it's a little crazier. And one of the things that we haven't had an opportunity to really focus in on, but we're going to today, is that there is a statewide issue on Ohio's ballot this year in the primary. Now, it's not totally uncommon to see a ballot issue on the primary. Usually they're the local ballot issues, though. Levy requests. I shouldn't have said it that way, right? But
yeah, well, some, but that's the way
it is. We're getting into this habit now in the 21st century of our state legislature deciding that they're going to put major changes to how we handle many things, including elections, on a primary ballot. Now, if you think about it, Chuck, why would you do that?
Well, because you want to entrench something that the old system won't let you entrench.
Well, yes, you do want to do that. You know, there's a couple other reasons as well. One of them is that because the turnout for primary elections is usually significantly lower.
Yeah, it's abysmal.
Than that of a general election. You know, sometimes you may get primaries. And I'm talking about during what I call on years, which are the even numbered years. Now, of course, odd year primaries are, you know, a totally different thing. You're lucky if you get 15% turnout in a odd-numbered year for the non-major elections. But this year is a major election year. We have all five of the statewide offices up for election, and we've talked about some of those seats before. We have all of the members of the State House of Representatives, all of our members of Congress in the House, who are all up for election or re-election. We have half of the 33 members of the Ohio Senate, so I think this year it's 17 that are up. And then we have one of our two U.S. Senate races is up this year because Sherrod Brown is standing for re-election. So this is what you consider a big year. And the even years usually are. And in this cycle, it's the statewide. And then 2 years later, it's presidential. So governor, president are kind of the anchor offices that are up in those cycles. But again, one of the reasons why you really would want to put up a major ballot change, and of course this is changing the Ohio's constitution and the way we do business in a primary, is because, well, number one, there are fewer voters to deal with because your turnout usually in a primary is abysmal. And honestly, if turnout's more than 35% this year, Chuck, I'll be surprised. And secondly, if it's an issue that you think that the more time a voter has to understand it and unpack it, the less they're going to like it, well, you want to get it in front of them as soon as you possibly.
ASAP, yeah.
ASAP. And this is one of those issues. State Issue 1 is a quote-unquote bipartisan. That should be your first clue that there may be some problems with this. A bipartisan plan to restructure how we draw and decide on federal congressional districts. Okay? And, you know, we've had problems with this stuff before. And, of course, you know, we passed – they passed a measure here, what was it, I think 2 years ago. Or, you know, it was last year. It was last year. To basically change how we do the apportionment – we call it the apportionment board in Ohio that meets after a statewide election – to once we get the census numbers to redraw the districts for the state. Now we're going to do it about every 4 years, it looks like, and it's not supposed to be that way, but the way they set that up, and this is the other issue, was that it only took one member of a minority on the apportionment board to basically say they didn't like the way the thing was drawn, and then they'd have to go back and start all over again. You get a two-year window, and then you have to go back and redraw it. So, and we know that's going to be a nightmare when that kicks into effect, and I think that kicks into effect in the 2018 cycle or 2020 cycle. But this one is to redraw congressional district lines, Chuck. Now, you know, right now Ohio has been, well, we've had some problems. And part of the problems we've had stem from the fact that we're losing population in this state. If you remember, number one, we don't anchor number of congressional representatives to population directly. Okay, we do in some instances, but if we went by the constitutional rule, I think it was what, a one congressman for every 30,000.
It's supposed to be more or less broken up. I think the number now is one congressman for about 340,000, around in that. In that area?
Yeah, it's more like 600,000 now.
I think you might be right. It's been a while since I calculated that.
Population shifts, and they keep indexing that number up. We have gone from, I remember a time when Ohio had 24 congresspeople, to right now we have 16. So we've lost a third of our congressional representation to the federal Congress in the last, I don't know, 30 years maybe?
And where did they go?
The most?
Where did they go?
Where did they go? They went to places like Florida,
Texas,
North Carolina, Texas,
California. Although California is getting
Arizona.
Ready. Yeah, California is getting ready to lose some congressional seats.
Well, yeah, if they do this dividing up of the state.
No, they're losing population.
Oh, okay. All right. So they are going to be facing that little problem too.
Yeah.
So anyhow, so what we're doing now is this bipartisan deal got cut to basically redraw these congressional districts because they started with this blue ribbon panel. And of course, the blue ribbon panel reports all of these things where they feel. And of course, the blue ribbon panel is loaded with what, Chuck? Establishment.
Yeah, it's swamp rats.
Yeah. So basically, it's out there now, and they're basically saying, here, let us redraw the districts and work this out in the way we want to do. But there have been people who, members of the legislature who voted against the proposal, who are out there giving us information on why they think it's a bad idea. And I agree with them, Chuck. I mean, if you guys support Issue 1, then that's fine, but, you know, don't come crying to us in about 4 to 6 years when all of a sudden Congress has become so liberal that, you know, we look like New York or Illinois in our congressional representation. And we'll just, Chuck and I'll just look at you and say, well, told you so. So Representative Nina Vitale, who is a great member from the Urbana area and one of our champions, had posted up on his public Facebook page his thoughts and points on the reasons why it's a bad idea to support Issue 1. And so so here it is. He says, if you want the short version, vote no. It's not perfect now, but it's a lot better than this plan. if you want the detail in 4 points, here they are. So his first point is that this creates a situation where districts will likely be drawn every 4 years. One of the reasons we do a census every 10 years is so that we can assess the population and decide how the representation will be drawn. Under this proposal, we have no new population data, so the drawing is done not on facts but on the will of a few politicians. I don't trust them to do the right thing. It has worked using real data from the census for many years. Using data is a nonpartisan way to determine how the line should be drawn. And he's right. We, you know, even though we've been losing numbers, they at least know where those population shifts are to know which areas of the state should either hold on to or lose representation or be, you know, subsumed into somebody else's district.
Well, now, another quick point on this, Barry, is that if you'll notice, there's a big fight going on right now about how the census will be taken in 2 years.
Yes, there is.
And the reason that is, why are people being asked about citizenship? The reason
they want to recognize and count illegal aliens.
As citizens of a district,
absolutely,
for the purpose of representation. That's, if you can't understand why that fight is going on, it's exactly what Barry just told you.
So that's a big problem. Now, Representative Vitale's second point, he says not later than September 30th of a year ending in the numeral one. So when would that next one be, Chuck?
2021.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Okay, so not later than September 30th of a year ending in the numeral 1, the General Assembly must pass a congressional district plan in the form of a bill by the affirmative vote of 60% of the members of each House, including the affirmative vote of at least one half of the members of the minority party in each House. Let that sink in for a minute.
Yeah.
Okay. And this is what he says. These requirements make it nearly impossible for a proposal to pass the General Assembly. If one party suspects that the plan favors one party over another, the bill will never pass, and the parties will never agree, almost guaranteeing that the plan will go to the unelected commission, which is set up under Issue 1. This is the entire plan. Get it in the hands of a select few that will do what the swamp politicians want.
Exactly.
That's not good representative government. The Ohio Redistricting Commission, if it met tomorrow, would consist of the governor, auditor, secretary of state, one person appointed by the speaker, one appointed by the House minority leader, one appointed by the Senate president, and one appointed by the Senate minority leader. They would make all the decisions. People fear tyranny of the majority. What about tyranny of the minority? He says, currently we have a speaker that has resigned in disgrace over an FBI investigation. We have one donor that has donated millions to chairman and other reps in the Ohio House, so she has control over everything, and she may be under FBI investigation as well. We have a House minority leader that is now accused of blocking child abuse cases and abusing his power. And finally, a governor who was voted in by one party to represent our values and is now representing the other party in much that he does. Do you really trust these people to make these decisions?
And the answer is no.
Of course not. You know, they can't even keep their own houses in order, much less this. But again, he's right. Even if it goes this bipartisan redistricting commission, it's almost the same as the apportionment board. But if they use the same rules, that means that not only are our state legislative lines, but our congressional lines are going to be held to the mercy of a single member of the minority party. That's what it gets down to. Now, you know, right now, we have 66 members of the House and 66 members in the Republican Party in the House and 33 members of the Democratic Party. If you looked at those numbers and said you had to get 60%, Chuck, how many votes would you need to get 60% of the total?
60.
Right, you need 60 votes. And currently, if you just needed 60 votes, you could get them all from the Republican Party, right?
Currently.
Currently, okay, but with this plan, if half of the votes for the minority have to be included in that 60%, how many votes were you going to need from the minority party?
Oh, to stop The reapportionment?
Well, yeah, to pass whatever plan that they have to come up with now in the year ending in one.
Well, okay, if I understood what you just laid out, the answer is none.
Well, no, it's 17. You need 17 votes from the minority party. Because that's the way the new structure is working.
Oh, of course, yeah. You have to parse carefully.
So it doesn't
matter
how many votes you have from the majority party.
Yeah,
you could have all 66 members of the majority party right now vote yes on this plan, and if 17 members of the minority party vote no, because 17 plus 16 is 33, so it would be 16 plus 1 to either pass it or kill it.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So then who's in control?
Well, an unelected board.
Well, but then who's in control of deciding how that of whether that board's going to be activated?
The minority is.
The minority party gets to decide, and they could just say, you know what? No, we like the idea because we know that the whole structure of this board is the same as what we did here a few years ago, whereas only one member of the minority, if you looked at this, you have seven members of that board, governor, auditor, secretary of state, so that whoever wins those races are there. And let's just look at current. All three of those officers are held by Republicans, right?
Yeah.
Okay, one person appointed by the speaker is going to be appointed usually by the speaker from their party, so that's a Republican. One person appointed by the Senate president, also held by Republicans, so that's five votes. And you got one member appointed by the House Minority Leader, so that's a minority party member, the Democrat, and one appointed by the Senate Minority Leader. So it's 5-2 vote, Chuck. So if the Republicans wanted to change districts up to favor them, 5-2 vote. Draw it again. And then the minority member can still vote. So who's in control of how the final shape of those districts are going to look?
The minority party.
Okay. And what's going to happen? Okay, here's the deal. What's going to happen is once they have basically counted coup over the stupidity of the majority for putting this on the ballot, and they have redrawn the maps in order to build their strength, if they become the majority party,
the rules
there'll
will change.
There'll be another move to change the ballot.
Yeah, the rules will change.
To change the rules. The rules will change.
The Democrats wanted nothing to do with any proposals to give the Republicans any power at all when they were in power.
When they were in power, that's right.
But now that the Republicans are in power,
not only will we be redrawing district lines every 4 years, we'll be re-voting on how we draw the district lines every 4 years.
Yeah, this is going to be a nightmare.
This is nuts.
Look, this is one of those things where over and over and over, we keep changing the Constitution, adding things that shouldn't be there. And this is one of those instances. This is a mess. It does partisan redistricting. Does it always mean that the party in power will always stay in power? And the answer is obviously not. Because the Ohio legislature has changed hands a couple of times in the last 20 years.
Yep.
This is a non-problem. The fact is that Democrats don't like the fact that voters have become more conservative just the same way during the last 20 years as in the last and the 40 years before it. The Republicans didn't like the fact that the Demers had the voters had become more liberal.
Right. And that the Democrats were basically holding on to the House for 40 plus years and the Senate for, 20 or 30, but that's the way it happened. And of course, then they get in power and they want to change everything. And now that they are, starting to fall apart from the hubris of power, now the Dems are looking at striking again. So, yeah. I mean, this is just the way this game gets played, Josh.
If this doesn't pass and Democrats do end up in control of the legislative apparatus, do you think that this particular thing is going to advance?
No.
No, of course not. Of course it won't. Because if they can hold on through the next census, they get to redraw the districts.
But their problem is, and the reason why they supported this, why it's bipartisan, is that they haven't figured out a way in order to get the majority again. They've been losing seats over the last couple of cycles.
Sure.
The Senate Democrat minority they have 9 people out of 33, Chuck. That means that they can't even basically get to 30%. they're under 30% of the total population, of the total population of the Senate. And in the House, it's the same matter. You know, the House, the Republicans now have a historic 66-member majority, mainly because the Democrats can't win elections. And of course, they'll put it off to, well, we need to redraw these districts.
It has nothing to do with taking odious positions about wealth confiscation, redistribution, gun confiscation, Justice Department revamping, that kind of thing. It all has to do with non sequiturs, it's all in districting. Well, of course it's not.
Right, it's not.
That's an absurdity. And Barry, again, the voters have become more conservative. That's the real problem, and they know it. They're trying to figure out, what they're figuring out is that in order for a Democrat to win, he has to run like a Republican. And of course, we all know that once he or she wins, they govern like a Democrat. It's sort of like, unfortunately, we have the same thing on our side of the aisle in that in order to win, people who are moderates or even further left than that have to run as conservatives to win as a Republican, and then they govern like a Democrat. John Kasich, who ran as a conservative's conservative, even though anybody who really paid attention to his voting record knew better. John Kasich's American Conservative Union score during the 80s was abysmal. It was below 50% sometimes. We have the same thing in Rob Portman, who just got an award for, Politico basically came out and said the most bipartisan senator in the United States Senate. Or actually, I think in the whole Congress was Rob Portman. Well, how does that make all the people who understood that he was running as a conservative's conservative? Those of us who knew his record knew better. This is what happens, and this is the shell game. We can't get ahead. There's no guarantee that if redistricting was enacted, this particular form, that in fact the Democrats would still have control of the
absolutely
of the apparatus.
Absolutely.
There's no guarantee
now,
of that.
Here's a couple more. Here are the two other points that Representative Vitale made. His third point says because of the way they've written the dates, this would have to pass the House as in what is called an emergency clause, which means an even bigger hurdle than 60% guaranteeing this will have to go to the small body to make all the decisions. I know this is in the weeds for some, but it's a procedural clause they put in to ensure that only a small few have control of the process, and that it never is voted on by the people. Well, Chuck, if a bill has an emergency clause, that means they have to get a vote of 2/3 to pass it as an emergency.
Right.
So you go from 60% to 2/3. Now, I'm assuming that same proportion would apply. So you now go from needing 17 Democratic votes to needing 20. Again,
I'm guessing, yeah.
Who's in control?
The minority party.
The minority
party. Let me ask you a question. Who wrote this monstrosity?
I think it was a joint writing between Democrat.
This sounds like a think tank. This sounds like a think tank, right?
Yeah. I think the original plan was written up between Senator, I think it's Senator Matt Huffman and Vern Sykes, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, but you and I both know when these guys write stuff up, they don't write it up.
Yeah, that's true.
It's
You're
handed.
Right.
It's handed to them by lobbyists.
Yeah,
I mean, okay, who do the research on what they want to have happen? And they find somebody who's amenable to it. That's the way this works.
Here it is. Okay, I've got it now. I knew I had to come up and look at this. But this joint resolution was passed as substitute Senate joint resolution number 5. So this came out of the Senate. And so I do believe that I'm correct, and I'm going to do one more check here on one other thing, because I can look it up real quick. Senate Substitute Joint Resolution 5. Let's see what we're dealing with here, SJR 5. Yep, it was Senator Matt Huffman and Senator Vern Sykes, a Republican and a Democrat, who wrote this resolution in order to create this congressional redistricting mess.
And it is a mess.
And it is a mess. And so, you know, they did this, you know, it's bipartisan, but honestly, Vern Sykes basically ate Matt Huffman's lunch is what it looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Huffman got suckered.
Of course. Now, and I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the co-sponsors on this bill, and I'm not seeing a whole lot of folks on here who we would consider conservative. You know, in a real way. And if you look in the House, it's definitely, you know, yeah, I'm continuing to go down. Yeah, it's pretty much all the leadership and some moderates who put their names on this in the House. And you had maybe a couple of what I would consider more conservative senators who probably voted for it because of their colleagues, you know, supporting it.
Yeah, it's a rhino parade.
Introducing it.
It's a rhino parade.
It's a rhino parade.
Well,
yeah.
Because,
and it's
okay.
Like, okay, wow, what a surprise.
Yeah, because it also empowers rhinos. Because
yes, it does,
if you can liberalize, if you can liberalize districts by rewriting the district lines, then what you can do is make sure that good conservatives like Ron Hood and those kind of guys absolutely cannot get a smell of an election.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Well, and if we continue on here with Vitaly's comments, because we're to his last point. Now, I don't think this is as strong a point, but I get what he's saying. And he says Governor Kasich, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and others who have very concerning records in public office, and he means Cliff Rosenberger.
Yep.
All say this is great and drink schnapps to toast the plan being signed by the governor. Really, he says, I'm sorry, but as a conservative, a freedom-loving Ohioan, I don't trust their judgment on these matters. Their swamp endorsement tells me this is a bad deal. Now, and as you and I were talking offline, and I mentioned to you that I'm posting out here, and I'm putting this out on post because it's something that I came up as I keep an eye on things in my realm when I deal with like life issues and things, and I got something that came across my feed that was germane to this issue. And so I put up on these Facebook posts for Representative Vitaly, I said, point number 5, Iris Harvey, the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood Advocates of Ohio, is on record stating the following from their endorsement of issue 1 last Thursday, quote, fair districts are necessary to ensure that policies are reflective of the majority of voters, not just the partisan few. By truly representing the people of Ohio, future Congresses will support access to the full spectrum of reproductive health care services, not attack it. With fair districts, your vote counts and your voice is heard, unquote. What's she really saying here, Chuck?
What she's really saying is we're going to take over the state legislature by redistricting and making sure those darn conservatives get broomed out.
Well, it's not just the state legislatures. This is Congress. So
yes,
she's talking about controlling Congress.
You see, I'm being too parochial here, and you're right, because it has to do with redistricting, and I think this is part of the shuffle, the shell game. People forget that this has to do with Congress.
Mm-hmm.
How our Congress is going to be constituted. People. On the state side would very much like for the state legislators, state legislatures to be consigned to irrelevancy, essentially become what Alexander Hamilton wanted, and that is essentially caretakers who follow all federal edicts, which means that all policy decisions would be done from D.C. instead of from Columbus. We already have a degree of that problem. But that's exactly where people like this lady who's the head of the Planned Parenthood. What is it? Planned Parenthood.
Advocates of Ohio.
That's exactly what she'd like to see. She'd like to be seeing it all done at the federal level and really, strictly speaking, by federal court.
Yep. Well, and let's unpack this just a little bit more, okay? Yeah, okay. Her quote said more than I think she was meaning to say. And let me reread the first part of that quote. And she said, "Fair districts are necessary to ensure that policies are reflective of the majority of voters, not just the partisan few." What's the problem with that quote, Chuck?
Well, the assumption is that somehow the majority is actually wants to kill babies.
No. That's not what I'm thinking of. I appreciate your point, but that's not what I'm thinking of. What I'm thinking of is this is one of these things the left likes to do. They like to tell you they like to twist it and basically tell you the truth, but pack it in a lie. Under this plan, it is the partisan few who will be choosing what the districts look like.
Oh, of course.
And so what they're really saying is we just want it so that we're controlling the partisan few.
Barry, you're so far ahead of me. Now, see, I'm assuming these things in my thought process. I'm jumping ahead steps. You're doing the right thing. You're teaching it from the aspect of step by step by step by step. And I'm taking three steps at a time.
I have to laugh, Chuck, because it is so funny to watch the left, because when they make statements like this, they inadvertently, almost always, really expose what the real game is. You know, her trying to that's the deflect. That first part is the deflect. Let's get everybody believing that we think that this is necessary because we don't like all the partisanship either. Bogus. They are more partisan than anybody, and they know that if this passes, their folks will be the ones who will be the ones in the vote on the legislative resolution and on this new apportionment board style redistricting commission, who will hold the swing power votes to approve or disapprove whatever everybody else comes up with, until they come up with a plan that they have already, and trust me, they're out there daily polling and canvassing and checking and figuring out where their pockets of votes are. Do you not think that these new congressional districts will start looking a lot more like where their power base is?
Oh, of course.
Of course it will. And their folks on these commissions, the hardcore leftists in both parties, don't just think I'm talking about Democrats, in both parties, will work on the floor of the legislature when this resolution comes up and has to get 66% for the emergency clause and another 60% in order to pass, will work to ensure that whatever gets drawn is going to favor these progressive leftists and these baby killers. And if that doesn't work, they can't get it the way they want it, they'll hold their votes, kick it over to a commission where it only takes one member of the minority to say no.
Yep.
Fait accompli, Chuck.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
That's really what they're looking at here. And she hat tipped it. They're not really after what the majority of the people want. They want to make sure that the partisan few that they are influencing and or controlling are the ones who have the ultimate final say on this. Because they know what it means. That future Congresses will support access to the full spectrum of reproductive health care services, and that's code language for abortion on demand.
Yep, which is the jewel in the crown, but that's not the only thing Planned Parenthood is supportive of. It's a whole litany of related issues or things that a lot of people might say aren't related, but actually are, because it all goes back to a Christian worldview.
Well, Chuck, I think that's enough on issue one, because obviously our suggestion is do not vote in favor.
I was going to say, let's bottom line it. If you haven't picked it up from here up to this point, 35 minutes into the broadcast, our recommendation is a no vote on issue one.
Yep, Yep, that's pretty much it. Now, it's interesting because, you know, this whole Planned Parenthood thing, it really kind of begs a question because just this week, the Ohio Supreme Court issued a decision. Well, and actually what they issued was their refusal to hear a motion filed by an abortion clinic to reconsider a decision they made back in February that basically said the clinic was violating Ohio law and can be penalized by the state. And they were trying to belay that and delay it long enough. But finally, on just this week, on Tuesday, or no, excuse me, it was yesterday, it was on Wednesday, the Ohio Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to hear that motion to reconsider. We're denying it. Our ruling stands, and the Department of Health can go ahead and do what they need to do, which is basically this facility up in Toledo, Capital Care Network, was operating without a license and performing abortions on women and sending women to the emergency room for botching these abortions for a period of about 8 or 9 months before they applied for a waiver from needing a license by trying to get a variance or in a transfer agreement, which they couldn't get. And then they filed and said, well, we got one, and it's with a hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
From Toledo.
And how they were going to get women who were in emergency crisis that they had botched an abortion on, and the woman was, you know, experiencing, you know, adverse reactions or bleeding out or things, they were going to call a air charter helicopter service that's based in Newark to fly to Toledo.
Oh,
to their facility, which is in a industrial neighborhood where there's no place to land, to pick up a woman who's in an emergency crisis, to then fly her from the facility to the hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I know where that heliport is. It's 5 miles from my house.
Okay. But yeah, so it would be flying from Newark to Toledo, which takes about an hour.
Yeah.
Okay. Then picking up the woman somehow, somewhere, not sure exactly if that means that the facility worker would drive the woman, instead of driving her over to one of the local hospitals to just check her in as an emergency patient, they'd drive out maybe somewhere where this helicopter could land, and maybe that's out at the airport, maybe that's somewhere else, but it certainly isn't in the neighborhood where this abortion facility is. Load her into a chopper while she's in medical distress, and then lift off and fly to Ann Arbor, which is at least another 40 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, well, look.
And this was their plan on how they were going to provide patient safety and secure. Now, what happened is the reason why they couldn't get a transfer agreement with any of the local hospitals was because they're performing abortions. And the state, basically, so the Catholic hospital system wouldn't do it. The state-funded hospitals can't do it under state law. So what happened is after the Supreme Court ruled in February, one of the medical systems, one of the private ones up there, ProMedica, decided to sign a transfer agreement with them after the fact. And they were going to use that to try to overturn the ruling against them. Well, the Supreme Court saw right through that. And, of course, ProMedica's taken it on the chin because there are large groups of pro-life protesters who are going out every weekend and protesting in front of all of ProMedica's facilities in the Northwest Ohio region. So they've taken a lot of negative PR for doing this. And so now it's up to the Department of Health to decide, because what they have to do now is they actually have to reapply for a licensure, just like they're applying for it for the first time. And I'm guessing, and of course we are advocating for and working to try to hopefully encourage the Department of Health to reject the licensure, because this facility willingly, knowingly, and recklessly broke the law for a period of time that was greater than 6 months, knowing full well that they were out of compliance with the state law, and they didn't care. And then their solution to it was to do something that anybody with any amount of common sense would look at them and say, this is ridiculous. So that's some good news. And, of course, we're asking for prayer from our folks that the Department of Health will do the right thing and finally shut down this abattoir up in Toledo so that the real health care can take place for both women and their unborn children instead of the children 100% of the time being slaughtered, and the women a number of times being injured so badly that they have to seek emergency.
There was a very high percentage. Now, you can't say it's every time, but there's a lot of women who are rendered sterile by abortion.
Yeah, it is. And that's one you really don't hear about as much. I mean, you sometimes hear about when they, you know, their uterus is perforated, or they're hemorrhaging because they nicked a artery or something inside. But what you really don't hear about so much is just that, that women can be sterilized by the abortion procedure. So very interesting to see. So we're hoping that another clinic, now what they did announce was that they were going to cease performing surgical abortions for the time being.
Which means they'll do chemicals.
Which means they'll do chemical abortions, which is just as bad.
Yeah.
So we're hoping that the Department of Health basically says, nope, I'm sorry, you don't have a license, you can't operate, period. Now, they filed for their license reconsideration back in March, so March the 12th. There is part of a state law that was upheld by the Supreme Court on the same day that they ruled against Capital Care. They upheld another state law that, oh, I don't know, somebody you might know and are hearing their voice right now, helped write, that basically says that if the Department of Health does not respond to an application for licensure within a 60-day period, it's automatically denied.
So in essence, they can pocket veto it.
They can pocket veto it. So we're hoping that on May the 12th or May the 15th at the latest, that the Department of Health will just basically say, you know what, we've decided that we're not even going to consider this because you guys were in such fight. And again, this is a facility that the Department of Health also fined $40,000 for operational violations and, you know, having unsanitary conditions. So they're sitting there. Now, they're appealing this $40,000 fine, but that hearing doesn't happen until, like, the end of June. And that's a federal. And they've challenged that up federally. So not only can they get fined $40,000, but if the state just holds tight for the next, weekend is the 28th. If they just hold for two more weeks and wait, they don't even have to determine the license for them. They can just say, we've chosen not to do anything. There you have it. And they would be done.
Yeah. I'm stunned that, first of all, that any abortion clinic would think that a helicopter, which is essentially a two-hour flight away, mm-hmm. And a hospital that is another 45 minutes, I'm guessing, flight away, not to mention having to drop down, pick up the patient, get back up in the air, and get there. I'm very familiar with the drive from Toledo to Ann Arbor because I used to live in Lansing, Michigan.
Yeah.
And
it's not a short trip.
It's not.
It's not in any way, shape, or form a short trip.
It's 50 miles.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it's crazy, Chuck. But again, this is what we're dealing with. And so, you know, so in Ohio, I think we're winning. But we have to fight our own Republican legislature because then they put stupid things up like this congressional redistricting, which is going to basically help send, you know, roll momentum and power shift into the hands of people like Iris Harvey at Planned Parenthood.
Yeah.
Now, funny thing is, if the legislature can't pass a resolution and the commission can't come up with a great plan, guess who gets to have the final say under this wonderful proposal? The Ohio Supreme Court.
Ohio Supreme Court. Yeah, there we go. Let's turn it over to the courts.
Yeah. I'm not feeling an awful lot of, you know, love and warmth about that.
No.
About you. okay.
No.
So we've got that. We've got that going on. Now, on the other side of the coin, we, like I said, I think the momentum right now is swinging our way because, you know, we've had these rulings by the Ohio Supreme Court. We have, hopefully, the Department of Health holding tight and making sense and keeping this facility from being relicensed. And then we have our friend, yours and mine, Elizabeth Johnston, who most people know better as the activist mommy, who just had what I would consider to be a fantastically successful event that if you're just watching mainstream media, you didn't hear about. But if you're hearing about from us and from others, you know what happened. Monday the 23rd of this month was national, and I should say international, Chuck, because we're now finding out that this thing took fire so fast and so hot that people all over the world were doing this. It's called Sex Ed Sit Out Day. We've been finding, and I've been working with a coalition of folks, including the activist mommy and others, who have been longtime fighters in the fight against obscenity, that most of what is passing for sex ed in our nation's schools, and I'm not talking about the stuff that Catherine does at RUC and others, but I'm talking about the stuff that gets pumped in from the national groups and from Planned Parenthood, is basically obscenity. It is pornography. It is getting into the nuts and bolts of how to do perverted sex. And parents have had enough. And so Elizabeth has been working through her activist mommy page and site to promote National Sex Ed Sit Out Day, where we're asking parents who love their kids to pull them from schools on April the 23rd as a protest against this obscene sex ed. Well, it was fantastically applied. She had to go down to North Carolina, to Charlotte, to do this because they'd scheduled a major rally down there around it. And it was happening all over the country and all over the state. But as I'm talking to her, and you know, we're going back and forth in the last couple of days, she's getting reports from overseas, from Canada. 90% of the students in this school set out that day, etc. And the funny thing was, she said somebody said that one of the administrators were upset about it because they were worried it might interrupt their testing and their ability to teach the kids something. And the person went back to the administrator and said, "You didn't say anything about when they walked out for the gun control rallies." Oops. It's like, yeah, so that's the reason why you didn't hear it. Now, you saw all the gun control rallies, you know, and the walkouts all over the mainstream media. But this one about protecting our children's innocence and, you know, getting obscene materials out of the classroom? No.
Oh, radio silence. Yeah.
No news story there. Yeah, radio silence. That can't be happening. Oh, no. This is just a bunch of reactionary right wingers, blah, 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 blah. Well, honestly, Chuck, this has taken off like a wildfire, and people are now jumping all over it. People are investigating their schools. They're investigating the curricula. And honestly, that's what we've needed all along, is for parents to say, wait a minute, I need to take a more active role in my child's education. Now, we know, you and I both know, since we homeschooled, that, yeah, we took a fairly active role.
I would say so, yes.
And some of us may be more active than others. And I'm not saying for me, because sometimes I feel like I never do enough.
Can you ever do enough? Yeah.
When a parent sends their kids to a government-run public school, they basically assume that the schools are going to behave like they would with their kids, which is protect them from things that would harm them and don't push things on them that they're not ready to learn. But that's not true. And this sex ed sit out is really pushing the boundaries and starting to show people what's going on. And I think it's instructive, Chuck, because the Thursday or Friday before the sit out happened, what happened in California? Do you remember?
I'm trying to remember.
You and I have been talking about it because you asked me a question about it. It was California Assembly Bill.
Okay. Yeah, it's 2493.
California Assembly Bill 2493. Well, and you know what? Let me even go back even further than that, because honestly, there is another bill that has been put forward, and 2493 is on the banning the sales or distribution of anything that would be negative toward homosexuality, which means the Bible being banned in California. Selling the Bible is being banned in California.
It's essentially about reparative therapy.
Yeah, but there was another bill that they also passed, which, okay, there it is, that basically made sex education mandatory for, and they started this back in 2016, and of course it's like a camel's nose under the tent. This was a bill back in 2016 that basically made sex ed a mandatory thing, which means that parents couldn't opt their kids out for grades 7 through 12. Well, guess what they've done now? There's another bill that basically says that that mandate goes all the way down to kindergarten, and that parents don't have the right to opt their kids out or hold them out from receiving this sex education, which includes gender identity, same-sex issues, and all of the perverted stuff that the sex ed set out and the parents, you know, parents protecting children folks are trying to stop in Ohio and other places. In California, which has lost their mind, they're basically rolling this out and basically saying that it's got to be mandatory and the parents don't have a role in it. Now, yep. Chuck, if you were a parent whose child was in a California school, what exactly would you be doing?
Pulling them out and homeschooling.
Right. Well, but again, there's a big push now in California to regulate and or try to shut down homeschooling.
Folks, we're going full circle because in the 1950s and 60s, there was a little guy who was an Armenian immigrant to the United States who became the go-to guy in legalizing and making sure that it was okay to homeschool your kids and teach them your particular values. And that guy's name was R.J. Rushdoony. Rushdoony made his bones going around the country and testifying in homeschool lawsuits. And he is instrumental in having gotten homeschool legalized essentially in all 50 states. And we are now going full circle with people trying to re-regulate homeschooling. And the reason is, now what's the reason that's given? Oh, well, there's abuse cases. You know, parents keeping their kids in cages and tied to beds and that kind of stuff. And there's no one to check and make sure these children aren't being abused. Well, guess what? There's I would guess that there's a far higher percentage. I don't even think I really have to guess that there's a far higher percentage of people who are being abused in public schools and it's never caught. And yet somehow we have to regulate homeschooling on this basis. Well, the real reason has nothing to do with catching abuse cases. The real reason has to do with homeschoolers are excelling. They're excellent at what their parents teach them to do. You know, you made the statement before that you don't think you do enough. Barry, no homeschool parent ever thinks they have done enough. Ever. Why? Because we want the best education for our kids. I graduated all three of my girls from high school. I'm always amazed at people that put their kids back in public school at high school thinking that, well, I just can't teach this stuff. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. One thing that you do in homeschooling, which is what these groups are trying to stop, is to teach kids to teach themselves. In many cases, you give them the materials. You carefully search out the materials, and you carefully search out the curriculum to give them the worldview you want them to have, and they teach themselves. Once they learn how to learn, you don't need to teach them anything. You need to be there to answer questions.
Yeah.
That's the problem, Barry. The public schools know they cannot compete, and what they desperately want is control of exactly what your child gets taught regarding social issues. And that's what this is about. Now, groups of places like California, which was one of the first places that legalized homeschooling, because R.J. Rushdoony was from where? California.
California, yeah.
And he was instrumental in making sure that California allowed homeschooling. And he was very formidable. In fact, I'm going to recommend a book that he wrote that you can still get, calcedon.edu, the Calcedon Foundation, which is R.J. Rushdoony's legacy, run by his family. He wrote a book called The Messianic Character of American Education. You need to read that book.
Oh, absolutely.
In fact, we've given them away. We had a few of them. We've given them away as part of our Constitution class.
I still have a number of them if people are interested.
Yeah, the Institute for Principled Policy has that book. Contact us if you www.principledpolicy.com. Contact us if you're interested in that book. Because really what it shows is that education is not really about educating your kids. not in how to learn things and how the world works. It's in educating them about social issues. All you got to do is look at, Barry just brought up the fact that the anti-gun march, where kids walked out of school, what's the first thing that schools did? They excused them. When kids walked out of school for the purpose of pro-life, were they excused? This happened not too long
ago. Well, I'll tell you what, Chuck, they may have been. Because that was a key point that Elizabeth Johnston and others in the Sex Ed Center were bringing up, was to request that parents force the schools to not record it as an excused absence. Because schools make money based on their average daily seat counts. That's how they get their money from the state and from the feds. And they want this to hurt. So they wanted parents to demand that the students not be counted as excused. Walk out and basically, it's an unexcused absence. So what? But the point is, an unexcused absence can't be counted for purposes of the school jacking up their numbers in order to get money from the state.
Getting their subsidies, yeah.
But an excused absence can. So they're wanting to make it hurt. So I hope that happened too. And even I was over on Red State, you know, Eric Erickson's. He did it like a complete rollout of the bill, this bill from 2016 that actually was taking effect this year. So he was doing this, but he was saying that, yeah, make sure that you tell them, do not allow the school to record it as an excused absence. Hit them where it hurts, he said. And that's basically what Elizabeth was saying, too. Elizabeth Johnston was saying as well, is hit them where it hurts.
Excellent advice. Make them jump through the hoops. I mean, seriously, folks... the days when you can send your kids off to school and not pay attention to what they're learning is long past. Mm-hmm. It was past when I was in high school and I graduated in 1975. You wouldn't believe what the hoops my parents had to jump through to make sure certain things didn't get taught.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, when I was in the sixth grade, which would have been 1968... We had a group assembly for the sixth graders where someone from CECAS came in. It was a sex education class. CECAS. I don't know if CECAS is still around.
Yes, they are. The Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States.
Yeah.
They're the 800-pound gorilla in the room.
I was not permitted to go, and my parents. I actually got pressure from fellow students who decided they were gonna quiz me on how I understand how things worked. Well, I pretty much understood it because my parents had told me exactly how you're supposed to learn those things. Your parents are supposed to tell you now. They're not going to be able to give you all the... they're not going to give you an anatomy lesson unless they go buy a book to teach you from. We did that. My girls were very well versed on the reproductive anatomy, male and female. Why? Because we taught them that. We taught them how the thing worked. Why? Well, you got to know. We also taught them some of the myths and some of the junk that boys were going to tell them. And vice versa. If I had boys, I'd have said, here's some of the stuff girls are going to tell you that is not going to be true. I didn't get that opportunity. I had girls. But we told them, you know, look, we gave them the facts. And that's what you give. And unfortunately, there are those who say, well, the facts include the fact that it's normal to have desires for members of the same sex. It's normal to have a desire to become another sex. It's normal to be one of how many genders are on the list now? 31? No.
I don't even know anymore.
Barry, it's two.
Yeah, I know. That's right. In reality, it's two.
It's
You're
two.
Right.
Yeah, there are two. Yeah. Are there degrees of other things that are problematic genetically? Yeah, there are genetic anomalies. Let's not kid ourselves. Most people don't know they're in that boat until they go try and find out why they can't get pregnant. Why, as a family, they can't have any kids. Oops, you've got a sterilizing genetic anomaly. Sorry. And, you know, you've got extra chromosomes. But that being said, as we run out of time, folks... this is the stuff that's happening and you can't close your eyes to it. Please don't close your eyes to it. Please don't. That being said, we are out of time. You know what we think, and we want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.